calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends. Coming up on today's program, Bill Falzon, U.S. congressional candidate in California's 2nd District. Just on the edge there of Sacramento, where we're on the air, and KSAC is going to be here on our Taking My Country Back segment, and an update on Veteran Affairs with Larry Scott from VA Watchdog in our 3rd hour. For our 1st hour, are conservatives hell-bent on destroying our schools, or conservatives would say are liberals? Dr. Dominic Maglio, a neo-traditionalist culture war expert on educational terrorism and how to stop it. Dominic, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Educational terrorism?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Educational terrorism. What that means to me is that when people are given a position and have a job description, instead of doing what they're supposed to do, for instance, teach a subject matter, they're using their classroom with a captive audience, using it as a bully puppet to basically tell people, especially young, impressionable people, what they think about the world. And very often it's skewed, it's unbalanced, it's not fair, it's un-American, and it makes these kids think, it really makes them feel that that they have no hope in the world, and America has no future. So it's a terroristic act, in my mind.
So we should, accuse them of terrorism and throw them in Guantanamo Bay?
I think that might be going overboard, but
I think we
should fire them because they are not doing their job. And I think we have to have standards in life, and we certainly should have standards in education. It's a government school paid by taxpayers. They're paid to do a job. They should do it. If they're not doing it, if they're just spouting off and they're not doing their job, they should be removed from their particular position.
Dominic Maglio, back in the late 19th century, a guy named Horace Mann, who'd gone over to Germany and seen the Prussian school system at work, a school system that was invented in 1813 in response in large part to Napoleon's having kicked the butt of the Prussian emperor at the time, who then went to Fichte, the leading philosopher in Germany, and said, how do we create an army that can defeat Napoleon? And he said, well, you've got to start with your children. You have to create an entire generation of children who don't question authority. So we will create a feel more committed to the state than they do even to their parents.
Right.
And so we will create a school system that is, number one, compulsory. So they will know that the state is more powerful than their parents.
Right.
Number two, that they will be required to ask the question, may I ask a question, before they even ask a question. So they will never question authority. Number three, we don't want them to think in a holistic fashion. We don't want them to put A plus B. We don't want them to have big picture thinking. We want them to be thinking, when you see the whites of their eyes.
Right.
So we break the topics into individual segments and teach them separately. And number four, we want them to be sure to be a person who takes orders. So we give drastic punishment if they don't take orders. And Horace Mann came over back to the United States, and by the way, it did create a powerful and marvelous German army. And so Horace Mann came back to the States in the 1880s and 1890s and started pitching this to industry up and down the East Coast, saying, here's the solution to the problem of people not having a good workforce, because so many people on the East Coast were migrating westward that a lot of our factories are having a hard time getting people. And he couldn't get anybody to buy it until in the 1890s, the legislature of Massachusetts, which had been taken over by a secret society, a Protestant secret society called the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, and they're called the Know-Nothing Congress of Massachusetts that year because they had this secret handshake and they said, I know nothing. That was their secret, except it wasn't a secret. They were proud of it. They were concerned about the Catholics. All these Catholics were coming in from Ireland, from the potato famine and whatnot, and there were now more Catholics in Massachusetts than there were Protestants, particularly in Boston, and the question was, how do we break the back of the Catholics? And so they decided to use Horace Mann's technique and go into the school and just have kids learn exactly what they were taught, without any dialogue, without any discussion. To hell with the Socratic method. Forget about children questioning.
Well, I believe in the Socratic method. I believe in getting children to think. I do not think.
This is my point. It sounds to me like you're saying the same thing Horace Mann was saying, which is we're going to have an absolutely uniform educational system teaching what the state wants taught.
You cannot get children to think if they don't know facts. We have to teach children history. We need to teach them. They have to learn. They just can't have someone what I consider indoctrinating them. Because
so give me an example of this indoctrination, Dominic
McLean. Indoctrination is what Jay Banish did in Colorado. It's what Warren
give me the example.
Does in the University of Colorado.
Give me one example, please. Let's just talk about a real case incident here.
Jay Banish.
Okay, tell me what he did.
Well, I mean, it's pretty well known what he did. He spent 40 minutes lambasting the policies in a geography class of the United States.
Of the Bush administration.
Whatever. It doesn't matter.
Okay, so he was lambasting the Bush administration's policies.
Okay,
and you think kids should be taught history in schools. Isn't this history in the making?
What? I'm sorry?
Yeah, isn't this history in the making?
No, because he's talking about geography. Not talking. Ward Churchill gets up and he calls 9/11 victims little Eichmanns. These are
that was in college.
This is using a captive audience. No. Let me tell you, I taught college for a decade. I have a college preparatory school for the last 23 years. You have a right to discuss things as an open forum where students have a right to have their opinions, and then you have a Socratic method. You ask questions, you open a discussion, you talk about things after they have the facts. But you don't just tell them what to think. Tom, I know you would be against that. You wouldn't want anybody to get up there and start telling everyone they have to believe in Christianity or have to believe in Islamic religion. That's not what we do in America. We have a right to discuss. And you know, if you ever watch Ward Churchill on TV, he doesn't allow his students to rebut what he says, and that's despicable. That's tyranny.
It's also college, and the kids can say, I'm not going to take this class, I'm going to take a different
class.
What you're really upset about is any teacher who dares in high school.
He was not in college. Banish did the same thing. No one can speak up because a guy goes off on a tirade. And I'm saying to you, you don't think that's education. That's not guiding anybody. That's telling him what to do. That's exactly what you discussed about Horace Mann. I'm saying,
why, Dominic Maglio, are you so terrified of our children being exposed to ideas or opinions that may contradict yours or those of the Bush administration?
No, I think it's great to have opinions contradict, but you have to have a forum to do that. You don't do that as part of a job description to educate children in a particular subject and go off on another
then you think that education should be entirely mechanistic and entirely mechanical, and if somebody is supposed to teach geography, they're just supposed to say, here's where New Mexico is and here's where Arizona is. They're not supposed to offer their own opinions. They shouldn't be saying, this is what I think about something.
Well, you know what? That's real nice. So if someone wants to talk about what they think, go on a soapbox in the middle of 49th Street and start speaking. If people want to do that, that's fine. When you're getting paid with government tax money, that means citizens' money, they need to do a job. I have tremendous opinions. So do you. You do it in the right forum. You don't, in a school that I'm, I don't go up and tell my students what to think about politics. That's not part of my job, is to educate children. It's to help them learn basic skills.
But what you are arguing is that children should be taught about politics, that they should be taught the official line about politics.
What do you mean?
Just what I said. You're saying that these guys should not be criticizing the Bush administration.
No, I didn't say
to not criticize the Bush administration is to implicitly endorse
ranting.
The Bush administration.
They're ranting. If they make a specific statement, look, there's a lot of things I detest about what's happening in the Bush administration right now. Detest to the utmost of my heart. I think that Bush is an economic internationalist. I do not agree with that, but I think he's been very deceptive about what he's done. I can talk about that, but I'm going to talk about it. Other people have different ways of looking at it, and you have a discussion. You do not take and just dominate and use your classroom as a bully pulpit, because that's terrorism.
So
that's
Dominic
terrorizing
Maglio,
our kids.
Yeah, I got your point. So are you suggesting then that we should just federalize education so that...
Federalize!
Right now we have a situation where local school boards... Dominic, let me make my point here. We have a situation where local school boards hire and fire teachers. What's wrong with a local school board saying, hey, we don't like the way this guy's teaching, and fire him?
Well, your question is, should an incompetent person be fired? I say yes. Why?
Well, I don't understand why you're trying to make a national issue out of this unless this is just another, you know, right-wing, be afraid thing, because school boards have the ability to fire teachers.
No, I don't agree, first of all, in government schools anyway. I have a private school. I believe that what we have to do, because...
Only people who have money should be able to send their kids to school.
Oh, give me a break. That's not... You're changing the sound. I was talking about people...
Well, you just changed the subject to this.
Huh? I'm sorry?
I mean, you just changed the subject to, you know, let's do away with government schools.
No, so, I didn't say that. I said I am not in favor of government schools. I believe, I was just speaking on another radio show, and the person said, I was talking about bullying, and the person said, well, the administrator couldn't do anything because his hands were tied. And I think that's exactly the problem in government schools. Their hands are tied. We need to have the ability to have free exchange of ideas. That happens better in private education.
Well, Dr. Dominic Maglio, drmaglio.com is website. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Good talking with you. Dominic Maglio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So why are conservatives hell-bent on destroying our schools?
Express yourself!
Yeah, well, that's why. Because they don't like it when people express themselves. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. There's a couple of issues wrapped into this thing. As first of all, you've got conservatives out there who don't think that we should have public education. Now, why are conservatives opposed to public education? You know, sometimes the arguments that they put forward are the ones that I was making about Horace Mann. In fact, the genesis of public education in the United States is not particularly egalitarian, at least modern public education. Horace Mann was trying to create a system where everybody, everybody would become a good little robot for the factories. But the reality is that if you go back 100 years before Horace Mann to the founders of this country, Thomas Jefferson creating the University of Virginia as a free college for anybody who could go, and communities all across the United States hiring the local school marm and bringing a teacher into town to run the one-room schoolhouse and collectively getting together and everybody digging into their pocket to pay for it, you find that the reason for education, for public education in the United States, is very simple. It's social mobility. And this highlights one of the fundamental differences between conservatives and liberals in the history of this country. The liberals like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, James Madison, even to some extent Alexander Hamilton, the liberals who created this country, strongly believed in social mobility. They believed that regardless of the economic or social class into which a person is born, they should have the right and the ability to move into higher economic and social classes. And, in fact, that was the case in the United States for many, many years. We were one of the most socially mobile countries in the world. We are now below the United Kingdom, where they actually still have an aristocracy in terms of social mobility. The probability of your being born in poverty in the United States and moving out of poverty is lower than in any other Western country. We are the worst in the world for this. And the key to, you know, one of the primary keys anyway, to moving out of poverty is getting a good education. Now, this works very well for conservatives who believe in a social hierarchy. And that is one of the tenets of conservative thought. And no, this isn't demagoguery. Go back and read Russell Kirk's 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, in which he goes all the way back to the 1700s, the late 1700s, and the arguments that were being, you know, the conservatives at that time. And, you know, all the debates that we're being having about what does it mean to be a conservative. And Kirk, you know, comes right out and says, you know, conservatives believe in a social hierarchy. They think it's the natural order of things. And Barry Goldwater was all impressed by that. And the conservatives of the day, William F. Buckley, I mean, constantly talking about Russell Kirk's book. I mean, this was the Bible for the conservative movement, The Conservative Mind, 1953. And if you're going to have a social hierarchy, you can't have social mobility, and you're going to have a ruling elite. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, why Limbaugh and other cons, who are the shock troops of the conservative movement, have been using the phrase elite constantly when they refer to liberals, because they're trying to immunize themselves from the reality that conservatives have been calling for 200 years for there to be an elite ruling America. John Adams believed there should be an elite ruling America. He referred to the average person, the common man, the working person, as the rabble, and felt they should have no play in democracy. They should not have a voice in government. So number one, you have the conservatives who are trying to destroy public education, because public education provides for social mobility. And if you have privatize education, you have a situation just like you have with healthcare right now. If you're a millionaire, no problem. You have access to it, the best you can get. If you're a working stiff, particularly on the low end of the working salary range, you're out of luck. You become one of the 46 million uninsured. You become one of the what would be millions of uneducated if we didn't have a public education system. So number one. Number two, there is this incredible effort underway on the part of conservatives across the United States of political correctness, of trying to scare the hell out of teachers in public schools and say, no, you're not allowed to have an opinion. This is the exact same thing the Nazis did in Nazi Germany. Any teacher who spoke out against Hitler was toast. I mean, in the early years, they were merely fired. Later on, you know, they would face much more draconian measures. They would be called, for example, traitors. Gee, where have I heard that recently? I mean, this is something I think, as Americans, we should be very concerned about, that right-wing talk radio all across America right now is out there pounding on the idea that our teachers are running down America. They're saying anti-American when they're actually saying things that are opposed to the Bush administration policies, number one, and which I think is very pro-American and very patriotic. And number two, we do have local school boards. We do, to a fairly large extent across the United States, still have local control of our schools. And I can tell you, you know, from personal experience, having been the parent of three kids and also being on the board of directors of a school for the last 10 years, that if parents don't like the way school is going, things change. So why do we have demagogues at a national level running around and saying, oh, this is a vital issue, we've got to stop these teachers from speaking out? And they always have two or three anecdotes, right? And you can, I mean, with anything, you can find two or three over-the-top nutcases. But that's, you know, that does not a national movement make. But shutting up teachers, that's what they're trying to do at a national level. I think it's dangerous. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Makes the Christmas right. Makes the Christmas left. So what's left? What's right?
Past the hour. A place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, that's me. Our quote for the day from John F. Kennedy. Let us think of education as the means of developing our greatest abilities, because in each of us there is a private hope and dream, which, fulfilled, can be translated into benefit for everyone and greater strength for our nation. John F. Kennedy. By the way, No Child Left Behind, another part of the assault on public schools, so much so that United States Senator Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party over that thing. Left the Republican Party. Said enough already because of No Child Left Behind. I mean, it was the straw that broke the camel's back, obviously, but I salute him for that. The only Republican that I've voted for in my lifetime, frankly, Jim Jeffords. And now Bernie Sanders running for his seat. I only mourn that I no longer live in Vermont so I can vote for him. But the 10 years I lived there, I loved it. In any case, the No Child Left Behind law which sets these, you know, basically the bottom line of the No Child Left Behind law is that instead of teachers putting together tests, you know, writing them up on the Mimeo machine and running them off for free or on a copy machine in the classroom and saying, okay, kids, fill out this test, you know, and or do the test in the book and fill it out and hand it up to me. Instead of that, the way that it was done when I was a kid, schools now have to go to private corporations. This is part of the privatization of education. They have to go to private corporations, one of which coincidentally happens to be owned by Neil Bush, the president's brother, and buy from those corporations specific educational materials and specific testing materials so that there is a standardization of education in the United States. Our guest's mention of children being taught history brings to mind Hitler's famous comment that the, you know, history is written by the victors. In any case, so we have across the United States children being tested based, you know, via this No Child Left Behind at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, the educational testing business has gone from a relatively small business when Bush came into office to $1 billion a year industry now, a multi-billion dollar a year industry now, because of No Child Left Behind. School districts are required to buy these tests at sometimes very, very absurd prices. And if their kids don't score well, they get punished. Now, the federal government also wants the kids to score well so that Bush can run around and say, see, there's no child left behind. It's working out wonderfully. Well, strangely enough, they've rigged the system. This from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Thousands of children in Indiana, and by Krista Stockman. Thousands of children in Indiana and millions across the country are not being counted in the federal government's effort to leave no child behind academically, the Associated Press has found. The No Child Left Behind Act, enacted in 2002, is supposed to make sure all students, particularly those most at risk, including minorities, are meeting minimal standards by 2014. But it is precisely the groups the law was meant to target that are most likely to be unaccounted for in the accountability requirements. The law allows states to set their own parameters for how students will be counted after taking state standardized tests. Students must be counted as an entire group in a school or school district, as well as in subgroups such as black students, Hispanic students, or Asian students. But how large the group has to be before it is counted varies from state to state. In Indiana, for example, test scores of 21,650 children, including a third of the state's Hispanic students, were not reported at the state level. Say what? Nationwide, the AP analysis of 2003-2004 enrollment figures found 1.9 million students, about one in every 14, were not counted under the law's racial categories. Minorities were seven times as likely to have their scores not counted as were whites. In Indiana, for example, Hispanics comprised the largest subgroup of 21,650 students excluded under the clause. The test scores of about 34% of the 8,793 Hispanic students enrolled in Indiana schools were excluded from the test scores at the school level. Blacks represented the second largest group. About 8% of black enrollment was not reported. Nationally, the AP found that Hispanics and blacks have roughly 10% of their scores excluded. More than a third of Asian scores and nearly half of Native American scores are not broken out either. Less than 2% of white scores are not broken out. So the mechanism by which they count the success of No Child Left Behind is rigged. I mean, it's done just like the Ohio elections. And then there was a fascinating study done by a group in Oregon. They looked at Oregon, and because Oregon has a lot of rural school districts, and because we've got a really funky way of funding schools in the state of Oregon, one school district might spend $12,000 per student per year, and another school district might spend $8,000 per school district per year. And some are rich and some are poor and some have high educational backgrounds among their parents and some have low and some represent racial minorities and some don't. And so they said, oh, this is a great place where we can do a test. And so they compared financial resources of the parents, financial resources of the community, poverty, community education levels. They compared these criteria along with how much money per student gets spent in 132 small and rural districts in the state of Oregon. And guess what they found? Quoting from the report in the Oregonian, written by Steve Carter, money has the highest correlation of four factors that showed an influence on student achievement. In other words, the amount of money that you spend per child is going to be the biggest factor that's going to determine how that child's going to do. Not how rich their parents are, not how well-educated their parents are, not whether their parents are white or black, not whether they came from a good part of town or a poor part of town, not whether the community is wealthy or poor, not whether there's a lot of immigrants or not, not what their first language was. No, the amount of money per student that you spend is going to be the biggest variable that's going to determine the quality of the education as measured by the competence of that child when they graduate from school. Pure and simple. Second most important influence on achievement, Johnson said, was teacher quality, as measured by whether the teachers had emergency or provisional teaching credentials versus actual credentials in an actual field. All over America, right-wing talking points are being exploded by this study. I suspect you will not hear about it on right-wing talk radio. The average difference between high-achieving and low-achieving rural school districts in Oregon, $1,625 per student. In other words, those districts that paid the extra $1,600 per student per year had the highest student scores in the state, and those who didn't pay the extra $1,625 per student per year had the lowest achieving students per state, and it had nothing to do with any of the other variables. Well, it had something to do. You know, they had some influence, but it really boiled down to, in education, you get what you pay for. What a surprise. You know, you've got cons running around. You know, they would be the first to say, well, I'm driving this fancy car because you get what you pay for. Well, I bought a fancy new house because you get what you pay for. Well, I want to have the very best clothes because you get what you pay for. This is a conservative mantra. What about education? Oh, no. Got nothing to do with class size. That just makes it more expensive, but that's not going to change education. Nonsense. Conservatives are simply hell-bent to destroy public education in the United States, pure and simple, number one, because it does allow for social mobility, which threatens conservative elites. And number two, they don't want our children to have critical thinking skills. They don't want our children to grow up to be adults who might question authority, because questioning authority is not something conservatives do. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joshua in Fulton, Mississippi. Hey, Joshua, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Joshua. What's up?
Not much. When I was in high school, I'm 25 now. I'm a college graduate, own my own business. And, excuse me?
Yeah, no, I'm listening.
Okay. Anyway, my senior year in high school, we had to take government, economics, stuff like that. And, and our teacher proposed, he showed us all different forms of government, from dictatorships to republic to democracy, all the way down to, communism, everything. He said, which one of these is the best form of government? And I said, well, even though I raised my hand, I said, even though it's not the best in theory, communism would work. Because everyone's on an equal playing field, and there's no haves or have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
And with a democracy. A democracy is looking after the entire group, not just a certain part of the demographic.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Republican. I knew he was a Republican. After class, he took me to the principal and the counselor and told him that I was trying to disrupt class.
So this happens on both sides, huh?
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. You know, I said, no, I was stating my opinion.
Right.
When, you know, we're in the South. It's very, very conservative.
Right.
And
How dare you advocate for communism or socialism? Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, I said, the Republic, what really made it mad, the Republic's nothing but a light form of a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And that blew him over. He hated that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to argue the politics of it with you, Joshua. I think it's a fascinating story, though. Thanks a lot for sharing it with us.
I appreciate it.
That's interesting. 1-866-440-8466. Patricia in Sacramento, listening on KSAC. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Tom, did you notice on your last guest, when you asked him, he made a comment about, well, I prefer private school. And you said, well, does that mean only people with money get educated? He didn't seem like he wanted to respond.
No, he didn't.
I just thought that was so interesting, because
yeah,
that's how a lot of conservatives react to that question. But, you know, I agree with you 100%, and it's so important to have a society where everyone it has the ability to be educated. I mean, it pulls people out of poverty. Crime goes down. I mean, there's so many, you know, benefits that go to this. But I wanted to add to this by saying I went to CSU Monterey Bay, which was a really progressive university, and I had, you know, a mixture of – we had some conservative professors, like in economics. And you know what? I've never had a problem with having debate in the class.
Yeah.
They allowed any type of debate. They gave you your opinion because we wanted to know what their opinion is.
And that's what you want. I mean, that,
that's
the American ideal, is that we listen to all opinions and we have a discussion of it. Patricia, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Great talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, please, Harry.
Things are looking bad. I know you would be mad to see your favorite man. They'll find the lad you love.
Indeed, we so need Harry Truman again. Good old Harry. I never gave anybody hell. I just told them the truth, and they thought it was hell. Harry Truman, the first president of the United States to introduce a national health care program, a single-payer national health care program. Rejected by the Republicans in the House and the Senate in 1946. Amazing. Welcome back to our program, Public Education, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Brad in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Brad, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I was on the looking on the web last night, and I saw three different articles about this, all repeating the same thing, and then I heard you say it, and I had to call in. The way that the reporting guidelines work for minority groups in schools. Everybody's scores get reported. Okay, but if there's literally, say, for example, one African-American family in a school of 200 or 300 kids, that African-American family doesn't get broken out into a separate racial subcategory. Those 3 or 4 or 5 kids' scores still get reported. They still count. Okay, so if they're doing poorly, they're going to pull down the school's average. The trick is, the last school I was at, for example, almost entirely Latino and white. We literally had one black family, 3 kids. All 3 of those kids were adopted. All 3 of those kids had major learning difficulties. If their scores had been broken out into a separate racial category for African-American students, our school would have been labeled failing because it's 3 kids out of 180. No Child Left Behind is a lot of stuff wrong. It's a bad law on a number of levels, but that particular thing is not one of them.
Oh, that's interesting. So the reason why these kids are not counted is to try to prevent the problem of statistical anomalies.
Precisely. And yeah. Again, you know, this is the problem. I keep hearing people say they're not counted. That's not true. They are counted. They count against the average of the school as a whole. They count as much as any other individual kid or any other 4 or 5 kids in the building.
Well, my position on all this, Brad, is that we shouldn't be doing this at a federal level anyway.
Absolutely not.
That we should have local control of schools. That I can't believe in my wildest imaginings that some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., or even some elected politician who has everybody's best interest at heart is going to care as much about how my kid does in my local public school as I do. And so, Brad, your phone line has gone flaky here, but, good point. Thanks a lot for educating us on this. Steve in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi. I'm just trying to figure out, I just don't understand how the Republicans get around the common sense logic of public education. The more educated somebody is, the more money they make in their job.
Well, that's what they will tell you.
The more taxes they pay, the more money there is for education. And more Republicans. So,
well, they're viewing it as a zero-sum game, Steve. They're viewing it as there's only a certain number of people who can really make it into the top 5% or the top 2% of wage earners. And, there's a limited demand for a limited number of doctors or engineers or whatever. And, in fact, that top pool is shrinking because now we've figured out ways to export those jobs. And so they want to make sure that it's their kids who are in there, not yours or mine.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
It's really fairly straightforward. And then the scam is they say, oh, and the way that we should do it is with vouchers. What we're going to do is we're going to get everybody a $2,000, $2,500 was the last number I heard for one of the voucher programs that was, introduced at the federal level. We're going to get everybody a $2,500 voucher. Well, the average cost to educate a student in the United States is around $7,000-$8,000. And here in Oregon, it was around $9,000. And so, a cheap a cheap private school is $7,000 or $8,000. I mean, a really down and dirty cheap private school that's doing a decent job, $7,000 or $8,000. And so if you've got a $2,000 voucher, you can't afford to take your kids out of public school and come up with an additional $5,000. But on the other hand, if you're one of the wealthy elite and you already have your child in a private school, that $2,000 voucher becomes a $2,000 gift from the government for having put your child in a private school, which, of course, is what the whole voucher program is about. It's about paying off the wealthy elite or helping them, you know, helping them out to make sure that their kids get, whatever education they want. And making it look like they're doing something to help education.
Well, there's still a logical flaw there, though, that just because you get more education, there are other jobs out there that don't involve necessarily being an engineer or a doctor. I have a degree in sciences and became a scientific consultant. Has
sure.
Nothing to do with being a doctor or a lawyer. It's a homegrown United States type job.
Yeah, no, but still, the reality is that the vast majority of the workforce of the United States historically has been blue collar, and now increasingly is pink collar, is service workers. It's not the quote white collar jobs. So and that's where college education usually comes in white collar. I mean, I'm radically oversimplifying. But I would suggest to you that the reason conservatives want to destroy public education is because they really and truly do believe in a caste system. And they don't do it out of some evil intent. They really believe that the most stable society is a society that is run by a ruling elite that knows best. It's a variation on the concept of noblesse oblige. You know, that those born into nobility have an obligation to take care of the rest of us, and they really know what's best, and they teach their children what's best, and the whole thing. And you see this right across the board. I mean, this was sort of how Joe Kennedy raised his kids as well. You know, you have an obligation, and for them, for Jack and for Bobby and Teddy, that meant, you know, go into public service and really defend the majority of the people. But for most conservatives, the concept of noblesse oblige means, like Bill Frist, his daddy's a billionaire, so he has to go out and promote the interests of billionaires.
In recorded history, has that ever worked out?
Oh, sure. It's a very stable form of government. It's called feudalism. You know, Europe stayed that way for thousands of years. Japan was that way for thousands of years. China was that way for thousands of years. It is, and this is the conservatives will tell you, it is the most stable form of government. It's just not the most free. So, Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. I talk about that, frankly, at length in two books that I've written, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, and What Would Jefferson Do? A Return to Democracy. Actually, and also the comic book that I did, We the People, Call to Take Back America. They all talk about that, how the conservatives really are. What they're really calling for is neo-feudalism, return to feudalism. And they're doing it out of, in my opinion, good intentions. It's just not I don't think it's the way that we want to live. 57 minutes after the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Karl Rove's job description changes. Is he going to lose his security clearance? We'll get into that. Scotty McClellan, he's toast. Who's going to replace him? We'll have a discussion with, in all probability, Victoria Jones, somebody from the Talk Radio News Service, about that in about 15, 20 minutes. Gasoline in Brooklyn, $4.50 a gallon? That's just one station. And it's a station that really doesn't make their living pumping gas. They make most of their money as a mechanic shop, and so they really kind of wanted to, they really wanted to discourage people from buying gas. And yet, people are still buying it. I'm telling you, the oil companies, they looked at what happened in Europe, and they said, people will pay $5 a gallon. People will pay $6 a gallon. They'll just change their driving habits. They'll buy different kinds of cars. And, you know, if you can phase it in over a couple of years, the auto companies will catch up with them. And, you know, the Chinese start selling cars over here. They get 60 miles to the gallon for $15,000, and people will change. It's the VW Beetle. Remember the VW Beetle in the 60s and 70s? I mean, it's all over again. The thing got to like 50 miles to the gallon. I remember I used to drive one that when it ran out of gas, it had no gas gauge. It was so cheap. It had no gas gauge. When it ran out of gas, you had a little lever on the floor. You had to flip so that the emergency tank, which had another gallon of gas in it, would flip on, and you knew that you had 50 miles before you had to find a gas station and fill up with your 25-cent a gallon gas. Boy, those were the days. Anyhow, just to wrap up on this topic on education, we've got a few callers here who wanted to continue talking about it, and then we'll get to the talk radio news and then to a lot of the other news. In fact, we have a Berlusconi alert coming up for you, strange goings-on at the Pentagon, and some fascinating economic news, a follow-up, in fact, to the story yesterday about the CEO at UnitedHealthcare in the Wall Street Journal. We'll get to all that this hour and next. Steve in Nashville, Tennessee on the line, though. Hey, Steve, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
My daughter carries a 3.895 average in school. She's a very good student.
Uh-huh.
And she was in algebra class where she carried a 4.0 average. Mm-hmm. Well, they have another algebra class that they carry like a C average. They moved her from her class to the other class, more than just her, quite a few students, to bring up the school's average in their math department.
So that no child left behind would be satisfied, so that the school wouldn't take punishment from the federal government?
Correct.
Yeah. See, I mean, this is the insanity of this No Child Left Behind program, Steve. And this is why I said this is part, and this is why Jim, as I said, Republican Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party over this issue, because this is a full-blown frontal assault on public education, just like the Healthy Skies Initiative is a full-blown frontal assault on clean air. They want to put more mercury and poisons in the air. The Healthy Forest Initiative is a full-blown frontal assault on forests, cut them down to save them. No Child Left Behind, a full-blown frontal assault on our public education system, and your daughter's experience is just a classic example of it.
That's very true. I couldn't believe it happened. I even went to the school and tried to get them to change, and they wouldn't. But they did make a deal with me that if her grade average fell, they would put her back in the original class. So far, that hasn't happened, but
amazing.
I think it's atrocious that they would even do that.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree, and I encourage you to get active in your local school politics. Join the PTA, maybe run for the school board, but at least join the PTA and show up and start participating.
Yes, I have one more other little quick question.
Sure.
When is the Democratic Party going to get off the fence and start being Democrats again?
When they stop listening to their expletive-deleted pollsters. I mean, the Democratic Party has become so wed to pollsters and consultants, and this is something that Marcos and the guy who does MyDD, I'm forgetting his name right now, these two bloggers who came up with this new book called Crashing the Gates, we had them on the program here a week or so ago, that they have laid out so clearly. The Democrats, not only have they become addicted to their pollsters, but they pay their pollsters based on how much media they buy, which means that they're always going to be committed to buying media, which is stupid. The Republicans don't even do that. And, on the one hand, the Democratic Party needs to wake up and start doing things differently. On the other hand, here's the good news. If you go to Democrats.org right now, Steve, www.democrats.org, which is the official website of the Democratic Party, the top story, Bush administration ignored report on WMD. Second story, unprecedented 50-state canvass. Today, Governor Dean kicked off the biggest, earliest, nationwide ever voter contact event in party history, the April 29th Neighbor-to-Neighbor Organizing Day. The historic organizing drive will bring together the national party, state parties, and ordinary Democrats on the ground like never before. This is the Democratic Party reaching out, Howard Dean, I would say, dragging them kicking and screaming, frankly, to reach out to people like you and me, to average folks, folks who are not insiders in the party, who are not running for political office, and who are not consultants, to reach out to the average working person here in the United States and say, hey, become part of the party, get involved with the party. And I think it's just great. So,
I am urging everyone to go vote this fall.
Yeah, well, not just go vote. I mean, participate in this stuff. If you go to Democrats.org and just click on this unprecedented 50-state canvas, you can become part of it and just go out and knock on some doors this weekend or next weekend and become part of the Democratic Party. And if enough of us do this, we will take this party back from the consultants and the DLC weirdos who are running it and the free traders and it's a tragedy what has happened to the Democratic Party, and we need to be taking it back. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you.
Pleasure talking to you.
Good talking with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joe in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great. What's up?
I'm glad. And I know it'll get better.
It certainly will.
It'll get better. But I'm going to completely change the subject.
Okay.
If and when we can get rid of these politicians, I'll use that nice word.
Okay.
And
speaking of the Republicans who control
our deficit is so bad, how much are we going to have to raise taxes on us poor folk?
Well, it looks like if we simply went back to the taxes that we had under Clinton, because the economy has actually grown a little bit since Clinton was president.
Maybe a little bit, huh?
Yeah. The economy.
Yeah.
The economy, certainly the rich folks are making out much better than they were before.
Uh-huh.
And so if we simply went back to a good progressive tax system like we had under Clinton, the taxes of people who make under $100,000 a year might go up a couple hundred dollars a year. The taxes on millionaires and billionaires are going to go up significantly, and we would have a balanced budget.
Oh.
In fact, we would be back to paying down the deficit. You go back and you look, and the two things that have run this country into the red are the war in Iraq, which so far has cost us about $400 billion,
right.
And there's more to come. And Bush's tax cuts, which have so far cost us almost $3 trillion. That's how much the millionaires and billionaires in this country used to pay in taxes, and they're not paying now. So all we have to do is just roll back Bush's tax cuts. And that's why the Republicans are hysterical, because a lot of these tax cuts are set to expire next year, and they're trying to get these things through, the millionaires and billionaires, funding these campaigns to get it done. But that's, frankly, I think, and I think most working Americans would be glad to pay Clinton's taxes if they had Clinton's economy.
Yes.
So that's it, Joe. Our taxes on the American middle class, taxes on people, certainly taxes on people making less than $50,000. The median in the United States, I think, is $44,000. Those don't need to go up at all. Well, you need to go back to a progressive system, though, where, frankly, I think we should go back pre-Reagan. We should go back to the tax system that we had under John Kennedy. And, on the first $5-6 million you make, you don't pay that much tax. But after $7 million a year, you start paying 50% tax. And it worked quite well for this country for the better part of 50 years. I think we should go back to it. So that's my opinion. Joe, thanks a lot for the call.
I sure enjoy your show, Tom.
Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Alice in Humboldt County. Hey, Alice, we just have a minute left. What's up?
Tom?
Yes.
Some very large demonstrations have been happening lately involving immigration. I understand they were so big because radio shows were pulling for them. What I'm thinking is that you and other liberal hosts should do the same when we have another peace or impeachment demonstration.
Mm-hmm. So the liberal talk radio should be getting people out on the streets to call for the impeachment of Bush.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a plan to me, Alice. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I think
that's what we'd like.
There you go. Okay. I agree with you.
Okay.
Alice, thanks so much for calling
in.
It's always
nice
to hear
from
you.
Have a good day.
You too. We saw this before the invasion of Iraq. I mean, this outpouring of people. It was these were the largest demonstrations in the history of the world. In the history of the world, people coming out on the streets saying, if you invade Iraq, you are going to have hand-to-hand combat in downtown Baghdad. And you had the cons and the Republicans and all these guys say, oh, no, they're liberated with flowers and candy and whatever. I think it's time for us to go out on the streets again. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, is with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So Scotty is out.
I'm sorry?
No more Scotty for Victoria to kick around anymore.
You know, I was
really genuinely sad when I saw that piece of news.
Well, you're going to have to train a new press secretary.
Exactly. That's a lot of work. And who knows, it could be someone like Dan Bartlett. I don't want to have to work him in. Or it could be a Tony Snow. And I mean, can you imagine that?
No.
and I don't believe
that's
it's
too creepy.
Tony Snow. No,
that's too
I don't
creepy.
Think so.
No. It'll or Dan Senor, or how do you pronounce it? Senor, S-E-N-O-R.
I think it's Senor.
Senor, yeah.
And the big question, of course, is did he go or was he pushed? You know, did he fall or was he pushed? And I think most people feel he was pushed, but you know, he was in the job for a long time for that job, yeah. And he does have a new marriage, which presumably he'd kind of like to have. And I imagine that job is not easy on the marriage at all. He seemed genuinely hurt and upset.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got to be tough on just life in general. But
I think it is. I think the significant piece of news today, which is getting some press, but not enough, I don't think, is Karl Rove's move, where they're moving him from policy, and I don't know why he was ever on policy anyways, because his policy is not his specialty, to sort of back to political strategy, or chief swift boat operator, basically,
is what
he's going to be for the next several months.
Yeah, the hitman for the Republican machine inside the White House, paid for with your tax dollars and mine. Now, Bill Clinton in 1995 signed Executive Order 12958, which says, and I quote, violating the disclosing an undercover agent is grounds for, at the minimum, losing access to classified information. Violating means any knowing, willful, or negligent action that could reasonably be expected to result in an unauthorized disclosure of classified information. And the agency head, senior agency official, or other supervisory official shall, at a minimum, promptly remove the classification authority of any individual who demonstrates reckless disregard or a pattern of error in applying the classification standards of this order. Do you think that Karl Rove is going to have a security clearance pulled?
Somehow I just don't think it's going to happen that way. Somehow I just think that they're not going to find grounds. And how they could possibly not, if anybody were to read what you have just read to me and to simply read the documents filed by either the prosecution or the defense in Scooter Libby's case, is a complete mystery to me.
Yeah, I mean, he was named by Scooter Libby as Official A, as one of the people who was throwing this information around.
Right, and then we have this meeting in early June 2003, the meeting in which Vice President Cheney tells President Bush that CIA operative Valerie Plame is married to Joseph Wilson, and at that meeting we have, among others, Karl Rove and Condoleezza Rice.
And yet nobody's being held to account for this, other than Scooter Libby.
Absolutely nobody's being held to account.
Well, actually, Scooter Libby isn't being held to account for this. He's got the problem he's facing is the same one Martha Stewart did, and that is that he lied to the investigators. He's not being prosecuted for what he did. He's being prosecuted for what he didn't say.
And he's coming up with the brilliant, I am an extraordinarily brilliant man at the top of my profession and of my country, and yet I can remember nothing because I'm overscheduled defense.
Yeah. We'll see how far that one goes.
Yeah, I know. He's got guts.
Yeah. Now, President Hu from China, who? Is on his way to Washington, D.C. for a one-hour meeting with President Bush tomorrow. He turned down an opportunity to go to Crawford, Texas. Apparently, he'd rather spend time with Bill Gates. But at the same time, his turning down the Crawford visit has been viewed by some as his kind of slapping the Bush administration. But now the Bush administration is not giving him the full official state visit thing, which is being viewed by some as a slap of who? How is this playing in Washington, D.C.?
Well, there is a sense in Washington, D.C. that this visit of who is kind of low-key. There is no state dinner. There is nothing like that. And from a press point of view, there isn't even the joint press availability. I mean, usually with when almost any head of state, both the head of state and President Bush come out into the East Room and the press get to ask a couple of questions. That isn't going to happen at all. President who is not going to be available, which means, of course, President Bush isn't going to be available. And generally, you get the impression that this is an extremely low-key visit, and yet the issues they're talking about, though not sexy, are extremely important.
Yeah, the treatment of dissidents in China, for example, the imprisonment of this American journalist. I mean, there's some serious issues that probably simply won't get discussed, or if they do, not in any way other than who's saying, hey, tough luck, Charlie, this is our country.
And there's a limit to what you can do in an hour anyway, but of course the deputies will talk about a lot of things.
Yeah, interesting.
We hope.
We hope. Well, you know, China is a sovereign nation, just like the United States is, and they have a different definition of human rights than we do. And anyway, it's an interesting situation. This is the whole dance here, and particularly who's being with Gates instead of Bush. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Victoria, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Propaganda, propaganda. Try and convince the folks the beach is never sandy. You can convert into lies what they've seen with their own eyes. It's amazing. Propaganda.
Yes, and the Bushies, they're so good at it. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where we run rings around the right wing. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. And so glad to have you with us. Interesting. Fossil suggests snakes evolved on land. Headline. That's interesting. So finally, something that didn't start out in the ocean. Although, in all probability, that's where they began. In any case... Time for our Berlusconi alert. You'll recall Silvio Berlusconi, the small-time crook, lounge lizard, lounge singer, and small-time businessman who somehow managed to buy a TV station, and then bought a radio station, and then bought another TV station, and then bought another radio station, and then bought a newspaper, and then another TV station, and then another radio station, and then bought the TV network, and then bought a radio network, and then bought another TV network, and then bought another radio network, and then bought another magazine, and a couple of more newspapers, and a couple more magazines, and another radio network, until finally he owned all the television networks in Italy, all the radio networks in Italy, and the majority of the newspapers. Then... he ran for political office. And guess what? He won. This was 5 years ago. Well, he was up for re-election. And it looks like he has officially lost. The Italian Supreme Court has confirmed. Now, keep in mind, this is even with his importing 11 million electronic voting machines so he could rig his election. The exit polls showed that he lost by 4 or 5 million votes, but came down to 25,000 votes somehow, mysteriously. It's all about Silvio, yes. So here are the story from BBC News. Italy confirms Prodi in the poll victory. The Italian Supreme Court has confirmed the victory as center-left opposition candidate Romano Prodi. In last week's contested general election, the court certified the results, giving Mr. Prodi a narrow win, as valid after a review of the electoral returns, including some 5,000 disputed ballots. Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has still refused to concede, citing widespread irregularities in the vote. You wonder if he's going to trot out his own voting machines and say, see? Oh, yes, Silvio. The Corte di Cassazione reviewed 5,200, this is the Supreme Court, 5,200 ballots. And said, we're not sure about these 5,200, but it's still not enough for you to have won. Silvio Berlusconi out on his butt. Italy out from under the thumb of a corporatist. And good on him. Congratulations to the Italians. So, you know, it's the corporatist lost. Now, the fact of the matter, the thing that concerns me is that he lost by 25,000 votes out of, you know, tens of millions of votes cast, and that he had to import these electronic voting machines at the last minute. Kind of concerns me. So anyhow, our Berlusconi alert for the day. Just as an update on a story from yesterday. Yesterday, you will recall, we talked at some length about William W. McGuire, the CEO of United Health Group, Inc., and how he has received compensation totaling $1.6 billion. A billion, of course, is a million a thousand times, and a million is a thousand times. $1.6 billion Dr. McGuire made. And just, you know, considering what that could have, you know, if he wasn't being paid all that money, how many people could have gotten health care in the United States? It's pretty staggering. So anyhow, today in the follow-up, that was, you know, yesterday I was simply reporting what the Wall Street Journal was reporting, and today the Wall Street Journal did a follow-up. CEO seeks to halt stock-based pay at United Health. I guess now that he's got his $1.6 billion, he's a little embarrassed by all the publicity. And so, you know, now they're saying, well, you know, we got to do something about this. In fact, I'd say this officially qualifies as a piggy's alert.
£91 billion, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the
refuse.
Yeah, refuse per every day. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
compensation.
Oh, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this extra.
Yeah. Oh, and that's even less than the $1.6
billion.
The big piggies in their starched white shirts.
Stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play.
So now the Securities Exchange Commission is looking into this thing, and they're saying, how did this guy get $1.6 billion? This is where it gets really interesting. How did he get $1.6 billion? And a lot, and in fact, his stock dropped $2 today, down 3.9%, apparently as a result of this story yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. Well, it looks like there is this practice that may well be rampant in corporate America, of stock options being given to CEOs and backdated. Now, here's how it works. A stock option means that you have the right to buy a stock at a certain price. Let's say that I run a corporation. Let's you know, just imagine for a moment that the Tom Hartman radio program was a publicly traded corporation, which, of course, it's not. But let's just imagine that it were. And the stock was selling for $10 a share, just to pull a round number out of the air. And, of course, if it's publicly traded, the price varies from day to day. Now, let's say that we knew, for example, that starting next week, you know, five new radio stations are going to sign up. So the value of the stock is going to go up from, you know, we can predict it's going to go from $10 to $11. Now, if you knew that and the board of directors gave me a whole bunch of stock options and said, okay, you can buy this stock for $10 a share anytime you want in the future. That's what an option is, a $10 option. You can buy anytime you want for $10 a share. So I say, okay, cool, and I take the options. Now, I haven't actually taken anything. It doesn't show up on the balance sheet of the corporation as, you know, here's an expense to the company, although there are people like Ralph Nader who say it should. And so then the stock goes up to $11 a share. When it goes to $11 a share, I say, I think I'll buy my $10 share stock. And so even though it's selling for $11, the company has to sell it to me for $10. So I exercise my option. I buy that stock for $10 a share, and then I turn around on the same day and I sell it at the market. I sell it for $11. So I make $1 a share. So if I had a million shares, I make $1 million in my dreams, right? This is what Dick Cheney did with Halliburton stock. He had millions and millions of dollars worth of Halliburton stock options that were given to him back when Halliburton was selling for, you know, what, around $6, $8, $9 a share before he became vice president. It's now in the, what, $30 or $40 range. I don't have the chart in front of me, but I know it's doubled a couple of times since he became president or vice president. And so you exercise the option, and then you just turn around and sell the stock the same day. So this guy is sitting on $1.6 billion worth of stock options. Now, if the board knew that the stock was going up and the CEO knew that the stock was going up and because of that gave the CEO stock options, that's against the law. And so yeah, it's so against the law that they make sure that, you know, because they'd have to, it just doesn't happen. So instead what they've been doing is they, you know, the day that the stock goes up to $11, might not even have anything to do with something going on inside the company. It might be the whole market is going up. Let's say the stock is now at $11, but last week it was at 10. So now the board gives me a million shares of options, a million options to buy at the market. Well, if they put today's date on that, it's at the market for today, $11. But if they put last week's date on that document, it's at the market at $10. This is called backdating the options. And what is being looked into now is the possibility that there's been backdating of options going on. This from the Wall Street Journal. James Bandler, Charles Farrell, Vanessa Firmans. Dr. McGuire made his recommendations amid scrutiny of the circumstances under which he obtained some of the $1.6 billion in unrealized gains he holds in United Stock Options. He and in some years, at least 10 other top executives of the company frequently received options just before big run-ups of the company's share price, which had the effect of making the options more profitable than they otherwise would have been. The Securities and Exchange Commission is conducting a broad inquiry to see whether options at many companies were backdated to benefit of executives, which would be a violation of security laws. United Health, a health insurer based in Minnetonka, Minnesota, has said that a board committee is conducting a review of current and past option granting practices and that it received a call from the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, though it didn't specify the subject of the call. So apparently they're being investigated for this. Very interesting. In other developments yesterday, Minnesota Attorney General Mike Hatch said he intends to join plaintiffs tomorrow in a federal civil suit filed by a shareholder that names as defendants Dr. McGuire, UnitedHealthcare Chief Operating Officer Stephen J. Helmsley, and several board members alleging that shareholders were harmed by backdated option grants. Isn't this amazing? I mean, you know, when you know how the game works and you see how these guys on the inside, I mean on the inside of the inside, these are the guys who call themselves the captains of the universe, you know, quote Jeff Skilling, you know, the true owners of America, the true owners of the world, the rulers of the world. These are the guys who the president has to take their phone call, right? This guy's worth $1.6 billion. I mean, we've got congressmen, I mean, Duke Cunningham going to jail for throwing million-dollar contracts to defense contractors in exchange for $10,000, $20,000. The kind of money that Congress gets, even in campaign contributions, is nothing compared to this. I mean, it costs, what, $5 million to run a Senate campaign these days? $1 million to run a campaign for the House of Representatives? This guy has $1.6 billion. That's $1,600 million. He could pay for House of Representative campaigns for 1,600 members of Congress. There aren't that many. You know, this is spooky stuff. This is what Thomas Jefferson was talking about when he said we should not allow wealth to accumulate in such large quantities that it threatens democracy. 46 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Dum, 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 you are. Ooh, yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, 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 you are. Only the lonely.
And welcome back, my friends. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. The place we're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. And, of course, if you're a conservative, you'll go to the front of the line, assuming that you are coherent. Marty in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Oh, hi. Yeah, Tom, I think we should pay a little closer attention to the wonderful Alice. I really think she put her finger on something.
Mm-hmm.
I think there should be a national day of impeachment. And you guys who have the ear of the public should should coordinate this thing.
I agree with you, Marty, but I don't think it should be done until after the Democrats take control of the House, the Senate, or both, because until then, nothing can be done.
Well, a lot can be done if we make our voice known, and we should do it before we blow up Iran.
Well, Marty, you realize, and I think a lot of people don't realize this, I'm assuming you do if you listen to the program regularly, that you know what a subpoena is.
Yeah, I understand that we just don't have the votes to carry it through.
No, it's got nothing to do with that. It's got nothing to do with that. This isn't about votes, because I think that some Republicans could be brought along on this thing. Democrats don't have the ability to conduct an investigation. A subpoena is a legal document that compels someone to testify, and if they refuse to testify, they go to jail. They can invoke their Fifth Amendment rights before Congress.
Okay.
And the ability to issue a subpoena, the ability for a member of Congress to issue a subpoena, in other words, the ability for Jim McDermott, in your case, in Seattle, in Washington, for the ability of him to issue a subpoena to somebody, to anybody, to say, you must come before Congress and you must testify under oath, is the sole province of the majority party.
Mm-hmm.
So the Democrats cannot even conduct an investigation into whether or not there were impeachable offenses because they don't have the power of the subpoena. And the Republicans refuse to allow there to be any investigations whatsoever into any of the crimes that the Bush administration may have committed. And until Democrats are in control of either the House or the Senate, because the Republicans will not allow it, there cannot be an investigation where those doing the investigation have the power of the subpoena. And without a subpoena, you are not going to be able to compel hostile witnesses, people who really don't want to tell you what they know, to come before Congress and to testify. The only reason that Richard Nixon got successfully impeached was because the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate. The only reason that Clinton got impeached was because Republicans controlled the House and a good chunk of the Senate. It just isn't going to happen until the Democrats take control of the House and Senate. I have signed on to this, impeach Bush. I mean, I signed the petitions. I'm right there with you. I think, he has committed crimes worthy of impeachment. However, if we spend all our time right now focusing on something that can't be done, we're going to mistake the opportunity to do something that can be done. Go to Democrats.org right now, and the second story down on Democrats.org is this national campaign that Howard Dean is doing to get people like you and me out knocking on people's doors saying, will you please participate with the Democratic Party? Will you become part of our party? Will you vote with us in November? That we have to do first, Marty. Otherwise, impeachment efforts are going to be meaningless because because they won't go anywhere.
Well, I think you're right as far as it being a means to an end. But I think you're focusing too much on the end. I think instead of knocking on doors, we should get a million people out there, just like the immigration people did, and let's go in through the TV set.
But if you want to get a million people out on the streets, the majority of people in America right now don't agree with you and me that Bush should be impeached. A lot of people do, about a third. But not the majority. But more than 80% of Americans believe that we should have a national health care system. Why don't we get people out on the street for national health care?
I don't care what you get them out there for.
But see, that's my point. If we need to be strategic about this, we need to be focusing on the things that where most people are going to say, I agree with those Democrats. I think I'll vote Democratic this year. Rather than, they just want me to vote Democratic so that they can impeach Bush. That's not a good enough reason for me.
I don't know, Tom. I've demonstrated on the overpass of I-5 for Kevin Benderman, and every tractor trailer that goes by gives us a beep. And people in their cars are giving us the V for victory. I mean, I think John Murth is right.
I agree with you. Let's bring a million people out on the streets to say get out of Iraq now.
Yeah, let's do it. Come on.
See, that's my point. If we take any issue other than impeachment, and that's not to say we shouldn't take impeachment. If more than half of America was in favor of impeachment Bush, I'd say that would be the issue that we should be out on the streets. But there's other issues that are so much more powerful politically that we can organize people around before the elections that will then cause people, undecided and swing voters to show up at the election in the ballot box and say, yes, I'm going to vote Democratic. And then we can take back the House and Senate. And then we can throw these bums out.
Well, I'll see you on the overpass.
Okay, good on you, Marty. And I thank you for being out there on that overpass. That's the hard work that you're doing, and good on you. Congratulations. It's great that you're doing it. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Time now for our weekly Taking My Country Back segment.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you. Like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bounced Iraq. So I'm taking my country.
Well, we're profiling candidates who are working to take it back.
We have a bundle and a treasury drawer more than there had ever been before. But every day we're down in deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get.
Or 2 years or whatever.
And you gave tax breaks to the millionaires. And you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today. Hey, I'm taking my car.
So a while ago, we asked Congressman Bernie Sanders, should people be giving money to the Democratic Party? Should they be giving money to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee? What should they be doing? And he said, find good candidates and support them directly. And so we've been on the lookout here, and we've been featuring good candidates once a week here with our theme music by Tony Stampley to take our country back.
I'm taking my country back.
And our candidate this week, Bill Felsit. Bill Felsit is running for the 2nd District in California. Bill Felsit, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's great to be on, Tom. Mm-hmm. Actually, the music you should be playing is Seabiscuit. My wife keeps accusing me of being the Seabiscuit of politics.
How is that, Bill?
Well, Seabiscuit was the little horse that could. They didn't expect him to win, and he did.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of what goes on in this district. It's gerrymandered or redistricted to be a Republican district, so I'm kind of fighting an uphill battle.
Right. Now, this is the by the way, your website, falzett.org, falzett.org.
Right.
And Bill, the 2nd District is right up near Sacramento, isn't it,
north. A little bit north. We comprise the center of the state, the Northern California area. It's the I-5 corridor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bill, who are you running against, and what are the issues here?
Well, I'm running against Wally Herger. He's been in office 19 years. He really hasn't done a lot in terms of leadership because this particular district has the highest rates of unemployment and the lowest family income in the whole state. In fact, we rival parts of the country, other parts of the country, for being the lowest employment and income.
Wally is the Republican, I assume.
Yes.
The Republican incumbent. And yes. And you are a veteran, a small business owner, and a clinical psychologist. That's an interesting collection.
Right. I checked on your bio. We've got similar backgrounds.
Yeah, well, you're higher up the food chain than I am. I only made it to psychotherapist. But anyhow, and your youngest son is a sergeant in the 82nd Airborne in the U.S. Army. This has to give you some serious consideration about what's going on in Iraq.
Yeah, he's already been there once, and I have to admit, I sweated. In fact, that's what kind of got me into politics, because I've been one of those kind of people that sits back and complains but doesn't do much. After he got in and went to Iraq, I started doing things. My wife got me into the Democratic Club, and I've been involved ever since.
Well, good on you. So, what's your platform, basically, Bill Falzon? I suspect some of our listeners, certainly in KSAC in Sacramento, are in your district and listening to this program right now, as well as web listeners and Sirius satellite radio listeners all across your district. So, why should somebody vote for you?
Well, the thing is that I can go into all the priorities that are wrong with this administration, but as far as this particular district goes, we need leadership to get us jobs, to get us income. Our current incumbent hasn't voted for job development programs. He hasn't voted for youth development programs. That's the kind of thing we need. I also believe we can be a center for alternate energy production. We have a lot of very smart people who work very hard to get things done, and they've been pretty much ignored. We have just tremendous potential for sun, wind, water, geothermal energy. We've got some of the most beautiful country in this district in the whole United States. So the forests are very productive, or can be productive, with the right kind of management and conservation. We can produce jobs and energy.
And for the people who might be thinking about going over to your website, falzett.org, falzett.org, and perhaps contributing or offering to pitch in and help out, volunteer, let's just go through some of the issues here. Changing course in Iraq, what's your take on this?
Well, I'm with the Band of Brothers on that. Most of us are in favor of some kind of phased withdrawal, get out of there. Obviously, the Iraqis don't want us there. Our troops don't want to be there. The people in this country, the majority of, don't want us to be there. We have an obligation to help out, but we don't have to help out by leaving our troops in there as sitting ducks.
Okay. So now, security at home. What do we do about security at home?
Well, this immigration problem that surfaced recently is really, as far as I'm concerned, a paper tiger. We certainly need to do immigration reform, protect our borders and so on, but we can do that in a much more common sense way. When you start trying to make 11 million people felons and then anybody else who helps them out a felon, build a fence that's going to cost billions of taxpayers' dollars, that's not really realistic.
Yeah, this is like in your living room going after houseflies with a shotgun.
Yeah, it's just not realistic. Plus, the real issue, as far as I'm concerned, is we need to take a look at free trade agreements, because embedded in those free trade agreements are unlimited quotas. Well, actually, they're not quotas. They're unlimited immigration of skilled and high-tech workers from countries that are signatories of the agreement.
And via visa
those
programs,
people, pardon me?
Via visa programs like the H-1B?
Yeah. Yeah, they get to come in unlimited, and the Republicans and my opponent have voted for those kinds of measures, but yet they want to scapegoat other folks.
Yeah. Now, you also talk about Social Security as a dimension of security at home, and other social safety net programs.
Sure. The United States is a co-op. We've agreed to take care of each other. You know, it doesn't mean I'm going to take you to raise, as we used to say in West Texas where I grew up, but what it means is if you have some difficulty, we're going to be there to help you. And I work with people. For 38 years, I've worked with all kinds of folks who've had, for whatever reasons, can't take care of themselves, and they need a hand up. They need some help from time to time. So we have to provide a system that provides Social Security for our older people and security for people that are having difficulties so that they can move up and move on.
Now, we have about a minute left here. We're talking with Bill Falzett. Falzett is, am I
pronouncing? Falzett.
Falzett, yeah. Thank you. Falzett.org, his website. Bill, in this last minute here, what should we do about our healthcare system?
Well, I'm in favor of single payer, universal health care, whatever system.
Medicare for all.
Yeah, essentially, if you check the research, you find that Medicare is the most efficiently run insurance company, health insurance company in the United States. There are plenty of ways to run a program like that so that it doesn't cost 25 to 35% for administrative costs.
Yeah, and Medicare is 2.5 to 3%.
Yeah, that's right. It's run very well. I'm a provider. I see all kinds of ways that health insurance companies are not only costing money, but they're messing up healthcare.
Great. Bill Falzett, F-A-L-Z-E-T-T.org, the website. Bill, thanks for being with us, and I encourage folks, and particularly in the Second District of California, get involved and get in touch with Bill. Bill, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for the opportunity, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, I'm just a typical American boy from a typical American town. I believe in God and Senator Dodd, and I keep an old Castro down. And when it came my time to serve, I knew better dead than red. But when I got to my old draft board, buddy, this is what I said. Sarge, I'm only 18, I got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Yes, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school, and I'm a-working in a defense plant.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, or smalldog.com, and also the Organic Wine Company. Fine imported French wines, all organic from organic grapes. Did you know, by the way, that raisins and not just raisins, the grapes are the agricultural product that has the highest level of pesticides of all agricultural products? It's because they're fairly fragile and vulnerable to insects and sweet out there on the vine. And so organic wine seems like a good plan to me. 1-888-ECO-WINE, the number 1-888-ECO-WINE. And, of course, as I said, Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX. Larry Scott is with us with VAWatchdog.org. Watching, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Hey, Larry Scott.
Hi again, Tom. Good to be with you. By the way, I was just listening to the music and thinking back, and my draft board didn't believe any of those reasons.
Yeah, there you go. And therefore, right?
Therefore, yes.
Yeah. So, well, you know, it's those were strange days, I'll tell you.
Yeah, you certainly were.
I suspect we could swap some interesting stories.
I know we can.
Yeah. Anyhow, the Department of I notice on your website here, this speaking of what we were just hearing from, what was it, Phil Oakes?
Or, mm-hmm.
I think. Is
I believe
called?
It was.
Yeah. The Department of Defense, I mean, this is sort of a backdoor draft again, establishing rules for mobilizing retirees in case of emergency.
Well,
an emergency like the invasion of Iran?
Well, an emergency is kind of in the eyes of the beholder, you know, who declares it's an emergency. What is really interesting here, this appeared yesterday, just a little blurb in the Federal Register, and was posted this morning on Fed News Online, the website. A Department of Defense is putting together a program to mobilize military retirees. How many military retirees? According to the Department of Defense, as many retirees as necessary. For what? To augment deployed or deploying units within the United States and overseas. Those are direct quotes from the Department of Defense. I think what we've got going here, Tom, is they need more people in the pipeline in case something really happens of a military nature, or in case they force something to happen of a military nature. We have absolutely gutted the IRR, the Inactive Ready Reserve. Those were the people who finished their active duty commitment and had a couple years of what they called inactive. As you recall, many of those, thousands have been called back. We have gutted our regular reserves and the National Guard. And, of course, the regular forces, our regular Army and Marines, are just at a breaking point. So what this does is put potentially more people in the pipeline in case they are needed for military purposes. From a military standpoint, it's a good idea. These are people who've been there, done that. They know the system. And they probably wouldn't give them a weapon and say, go fight. What they would do is they would put them in administrative areas behind a desk shuffling papers or perhaps in training missions. But they have been in the military. They know the language. They know what is supposed to go on. So from a Department of Defense standpoint, this is good. From the standpoint of what is being planned in Washington, D.C., this is kind of scary.
Well, I have a different theory, Larry. I suspect that what they plan on doing is calling back into active service and tossing them right into the front lines of Iraq, six vets.
Six
vets. They all happen to be generals. And this is the legal stuff that they've got to do.
You may be right on that one. There are some generals, or retired generals, I should say, who are feeling the heat right about now.
Right, right. And so if they're talking about mobilizing retirees, I have a feeling I know where they'll start. Well, moving along, we only have a minute or so left here, okay. A minute and a half. Carl Schwartz and his shadowy company, Patmos Nanotechnologies, are looking for veterans to be guinea pigs?
Well, it is really kind of an interesting story because there are all kinds of links here. There is a website called Gulf Vets Survey. They're asking for personal information, name, address, phone number, email, and medical information from veterans who served during the Gulf War. They are not affiliated with any recognized veterans group. They're not affiliated with any medical institution that we can find out. And when we started digging and I contacted a couple of the people behind the website, they are affiliated with what is called a veterans organization that really doesn't serve veterans. They're a political action committee. They are also associated with a person who claims to have developed some type of a treatment. And also the people that own the website are an internet marketing company. So we have all kinds of bizarre
who sell things. Your personal information.
That's right. The bottom line here is they will not tell anyone what they are doing with the veterans' information.
Well,
our suggestion, and it's a very, very important suggestion, stay away from Gulf Vet Survey. Do not provide them with personal information.
Yeah, well said. Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VA Watchdog, vawatchdog.org. And we've just scratched the surface here, Larry. Let me encourage all of our veterans and people who are supporters of veterans, Americans, to go to vawatchdog.org and check out all the information there. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Good talking with you.
Good talking with you, too. 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media would rather not.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, it's Tom Lehrer.
When someone makes a move of which we don't approve, who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines. We'll send them all we've got. John Wayne and Randolph Scott. Remember those exciting fighting scenes. To the shores of Tripoli, but not to Mississippi. What do? We send the Marines. For might makes right. Until they've seen the light, they've got to be protected, all their rights respected, till somebody we like can be elected. Members of the Corps all hate the thought of war. They'd rather kill them off by peaceful means. Stop calling it aggression. Ooh, we hate that expression. We only want the world to know that we support the status quo. They love us everywhere we go, so when in doubt, send the Marines.
Indeed. 35 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, that was prescient. That song is at least 20, maybe I'd say at least 30 years old. And he's like, to the shores of Tripoli, but not Mississippi. And, we're not sending guys down to help rebuild New Orleans, but we are sending them over to rebuild Iraq. What's wrong with this picture? Our quote for the day from John Kennedy: let us think of education as the means of developing our greatest abilities, because in each of us there is a private hope and dream which, fulfilled, can be translated into benefit for everyone and greater strength for our nation. John F. Kennedy. This was back when all of us understood that government is part of the social contract, that we're all in this together, that a nation, that being an American meant being part of a nation, not being an individual who stood alone trying to rake off millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars at the expense of everybody else in, for example, a privatized for-profit health system, as we're seeing. So our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, toll free. And, of course, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, you can go to tomhartman.com and click the live chat link. 36 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman with you, and Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Will, what's up? Will, I'm not hearing you. Will, I'm going to have to put you back on hold, and we'll just go see if Tom in Minneapolis wants to try. Hey, Tom.
Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, you mentioned yesterday about how the Republicans are going to try to hide behind Bush and say, yeah, I'm against Bush too. I'm not as bad as him, and vote me in. You had a caller today talking about we need to impeach Bush. Even your guest today said, well, I detest Bush. Yeah. See, we got to talk about the Republicans are the ones at fault. It's the ideology that's at fault.
Well, and that even goes beyond the party, Tom. My position, see, Rush Limbaugh framed this brilliantly 15 years ago. He didn't go after the Democrats. He went after the liberals.
Right.
And we need to be not going after the Republicans. We need to be going after conservatives, because it's conservatives who are taking this country apart. It's conservatives who are deconstructing our social contract. It's conservatives who don't believe in democracy. It's conservatives who believe in rule by the rich. And there are a few Republicans who are actually liberals, and there are a few Democrats who are actually conservatives. And a pox on all of the Democrats and the Republicans who are conservatives, in my opinion.
I agree with that. I agree that, but they have. If you do that, you'll give the Republicans another way out by saying, well, I'm kind of more liberal than Bush.
No, they're not going to say that, see, because the word liberal has been demonized. What they'll do is they'll try to say that they're moderate.
Right.
And you know, that's the position that they're all trying to take. This is the Chuck Hagel
position. See, when you go into the voting booth, what's next to the name is an R or a D, not an L or a C. And I'm just saying, you got to put the tag on the letter R, Republican, to throw these bums out.
Now, I agree, but we also have to take it a step beyond that. I live in Oregon, for example, which is a fairly progressive state. We have a Democratic governor who is a very progressive guy. We've got a Democratic senator, Ron Wyden, who's a fairly progressive senator. I mean, he's not the very best, but he's certainly not the very worst. He's a good guy. I have a lot of respect.
He's better than Zell Miller.
he's better than three quarters of them, frankly.
Right.
But you know, he's no Russ Feingold, but he's a good guy. And we have Gordon Smith, a Republican, who is running for re-election in another 2 years. And I kid you not, Tom, whenever the local newspaper writes a story about Gordon Smith, they put the word moderate in front of his name.
I know
moderate
that.
Republican Gordon Smith. And you look at his voting record, and there's nothing moderate about it. The guy's a right-wing crank.
That's why
he comes into the state. But he comes into the state, and he talks about being a moderate. He uses the word moderate in his speeches and all that. This is why I think that we need to characterize the Republican right-wingers as right-wingers. I don't think, frankly, that, I don't think, frankly, that Olympia Snow or Susan Collins should be turned down by the people of Maine. But on the other hand, they are helping hold together a Republican majority. So
I'll correct myself in line right here. Yesterday you were saying, Rove doesn't care that Bush is unpopular. They don't want to go to jail. They want to hold the House and the Senate.
That's the bottom line. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. Okay, well said, Tom. We may have, I won't say we have a disagreement on strategy. I don't think we've achieved a consensus. But the bottom line is whether it is labeling these guys as conservatives or identifying the Republicans as right-wing extremists or whatever. I think what we need to begin doing is disassociating the rest of the Republicans out there from Bush, because they're going to do it themselves come Election Day. And they all realize that about 80% of the people who vote really only started paying attention to the election about a month before the election. And that's when they start carpet bombing the country with money. So, we need to be working on this and making it stick. Tom, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Greg in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today?
Hello.
Hey, Greg, you're live and on the air.
Oh, okay, great. I really appreciate some of your things that you come up with. Sometimes you go over them really quick. One of them today was your comment about neo-feudalism.
Right.
And, I think that what I'm kind of guessing by the way the whole bankrupting of America is going is that that's going to put America up for sale on the cheap. And it's going to
already
cause...
Has.
Well,
already,
yeah,
already has.
I mean, it is happening. Yeah, Tom, you're kind of breaking a little bit there. But, basically, if people need to envision this, what this means, you can look at... A 50,000 acre ranch that is on part of in part of Texas. You got the Texas state government there, you got a county government there, and they turn out to be a law unto themselves. And police come to investigate a shooting incident on a 50,000 acre Texas ranch, I think owned by somebody named Armstrong, and they're kind of pushed aside.
Sure.
And,
come back tomorrow. The vice president needs to go home and have a martini.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, this is kind of how these things work. In other words, when I first got a hold of this whole neo-feudalism idea, I thought, oh, okay, well, after the complete collapse of the United States, then maybe something like this will happen. Well, no,
we're in the middle of it right now.
It's happening side by side, on a parallel track to everything else that folks like you and I think is going on in our lives. Well, when you got this super rich ownership, if you got a super rich neighbor, they're going to have a lot of sway over you, even maybe more so than local governments.
Yeah, and it's really not about class warfare. It's really not about let's blame the rich for everything, anything like that. What's really going on, Greg, is that there is a small group of individuals in the United States, and it's probably not more than, I would be surprised if there's even 100,000 of them. It's a relatively small group of individuals in the United States who really, truly don't believe in democracy and really think, and the neocons are certainly part of this, in fact, probably leading the choir, and absolutely believe that they are patriots, that they love this country, and that the best thing to do for this country is to rescue it from the tyranny of the majority, to paraphrase
mm-hmm.
John Adams, to rescue it from the dangerous instability of democracy, to directly quote Thomas Jefferson, although he was saying that he would prefer the dangerous instability of democracy to all other political systems. And they look around and you look back at Leo Strauss and you look at his writings and what has been written about him. And in the 1960s, the 1970s, which arguably in the 20th century was the peak of power for the middle class, it was also the peak of standing up to authority. And these guys looked at this and they said, whoa, this is really dangerous. This is the middle class speaking out. There could be instability here. We had cities in flames. We had the SDS. We had students standing up. We had African Americans standing up. All the traditional essentially oppressed classes were saying no more. We all want to be part of the middle class. And the ruling elites were saying, oh, we can't have this. We've got to do something about this. We've got to put these people back into not total poverty, but down to the point where we can control them, which is the goal of feudalism. In feudalism, you are dependent for your survival on the person who owns the property, who technically owns you as well. And that now is the employer. We have people all across the United States who are afraid to tell their employer what they really think because they know that even if they could find another job, if they lose their health insurance and have to get a new policy, the medical condition that they already have will no longer be covered, and they will be wiped out if their whatever it is, their diabetes, their arthritis, fill in the blank, flares up.
Metaphorical question,
yeah.
Which is, in neo-feudalism, couldn't the local duke or the local prince be more powerful than the king?
Well, in fact, in feudal society, the kings, the height of feudalism was in 1215, when the nobles said to King John on the plain in Runnymede, you are going to sign this document, the Magna Carta, and you are going to acknowledge that we have these rights, otherwise we won't allow you to continue playing king. And I would suggest that that time has already come as well. George W. Bush does not dare defy the corporate powers in this country. And you know, you could say, oh, he's working on their favor. I would say he doesn't have any choice. So, you know, I would say that we are already largely there. Greg, if you want to really dig into this, I wrote a book about this called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And not to plug my own book, but it's a pretty good analysis of it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's amazing. I'm looking at the April futures here. Oil, $71.95. $72 a barrel. This is incredible. Copper, $2.92 a pound. Copper was like 30, 40, 50 cents, something like that. It was in the neighborhood. It was under 50 cents when Bush came into office. $2.92 a pound now. Gold was at $280 more or less an ounce when Bush came into office. $636. Silver, as I recall, silver was around 9, 10, 11. I don't like follow this stuff fastidiously. I've just been noticing it recently because this is the canary in the mine shaft stuff. These are the indicators that the U.S. dollar is about to go in the tank. And I've been watching these carefully ever since the end of March when the federal government stopped publishing M3, stopped publishing the number that tells citizens of the United States and the world how much they're inflating our currency. That is how much they're diluting the U.S. dollar. So that they can borrow with valuable dollars and pay them off with cheap dollars, which is what governments have to do when they get backed into corners like George W. Bush has backed us into with massive debt as a consequence of huge shifts of revenue away from we the people and into the pockets of the very, very wealthy and powerful. It's absolutely incredible. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin.
Hey, Tom. What they do, the elite that own the media,
yes, sir,
and the means of portraying what's taking place in the economy and in our lives, health care and everything, what they do, because they are a monopoly, is they perpetrate what the propagandists do, and that's 10% of the truth and 90% of propaganda. Case in point, health insurers for all practical purposes, and providers, health providers in this country. It's two titans fighting it out now, the way it looks to me.
Oh, yeah. In fact, if you look at MarketWatch, they just did an article, Russ Britt, the lead sentence, Armin. A study released Monday is expected to raise concerns that health insurer consolidation is reaching near monopolies in virtually all reaches of the U.S., with the most dominant firms grabbing more market share by several percentage points a year.
Well, see, here's the thing that we need to explain to people here, because what these spinmeisters do, they are very professional at either programming and brainwashing people in inverted Orwellian dimension, or if they can't do that, they confuse them to where they just give up and say, the hell with it, I don't understand it. But the point being is, a monopoly, Tom.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, this goes on. It says the study also shows that in 166 of 294 metropolitan areas, which would be basically
90%.
Every major city in America, 166 of 294 metro areas, a single insurer controls more than 56% of the business in health maintenance organizations and preferred provider networks, PPOs and HMOs in underwriting. I mean, it's just, you're absolutely right. The health industry has become a monopoly, and it's a monopoly that needs to be addressed by the Securities Exchange Commission and taken apart. I'm with you, Armin. Jim in Pittsburgh, and thank you for the call. Jim, as always,
Tom.
Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, Tom, I'm wondering, you know, about these illegal aliens coming to this country. Never in the history of the world have I seen anyone open the doors and let that many illegals come across their border, situate themselves all across the 50 states, and the Homeland Security does nothing, and probably our people in Washington, D.C. has a helping hand in there. So,
yeah, you think that's a problem, Jim. Listen to this.
When I look at terrorists, I don't look at some foreign country. I look at what's being built up in this country, and we're not doing anything about it. You know, the big money is talking, and they're giving you all kinds of spin stories in it. We should just get every one of them and vote them out. I don't care. There should be no Republican govern us.
Yeah, well said, Jim, and that's the bottom line. And here's what's weird. The Republican Party, the GOP right now, is paying for ads in Spanish.
Right.
That run on Spanish language stations that say that the Democrats are trying to make criminals out of aliens.
They are
aliens.
Criminals.
And, but the point is, well, they're civic criminals. They're not yet felons.
We don't know that.
The bill that would felonize, that would make felons out of illegal immigrants was passed by the Republican House of Representatives by Republicans.
Right.
And those same Republicans are, and that bill is very unpopular with the illegal immigrants. That's what brought them out into the streets. The same Republican Party, the GOP under Ken Mellman right now is running ads on Spanish language stations in Spanish, saying that the Democrats are responsible for trying to criminalize illegal immigration. And they know that this, you know, the Democrats are sitting around waiting, right? And the labor parties, the AFL-CIO, they sit around saying, oh, yeah, we'll just make all these guys citizens and they'll all become good Democrats. And right now, the Republicans are reaching out to them saying the Democrats are evil. They're the ones who are trying to hurt you. On the one hand, while on the other hand, it's the Republicans themselves that are trying to criminalize them. It is absolutely bizarre. And I agree that it's a terrible problem on both sides. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we've got 1 minute left. What's on your mind, Will?
I'll make it snappy. Tom, thank you. And I love the fact that you play those excerpts from audio from way back, 50 years ago.
Yeah. Those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it.
Tom, I'll tell you what, I hope you do more of that.
I will.
I mean it. Teddy Roosevelt was one of my heroes from. But when you play it, it's really emotional for me.
Yeah, it is for me too.
I don't know how you find it, but please do that.
Sure, but that's not what you called about, and we got a half a minute left.
Yeah, I'll make it snappy. You're doomed. You are doomed. So are the American people. There are two hoodlum governments. That's why I called. There's no difference between these two parties. They're both hoodlums. They're crooks.
The Republicans and the Democrats you're talking about.
But no, I'm talking about both of them, Tom.
Yeah, you're saying that they're both corrupt. Will, I have to respectfully disagree with you. I would say that there is a lot of corruption in the Democratic Party, and the entire Republican Party right now is being run like organized crime. But we can talk about it in more depth tomorrow. Give me a call, and we'll get into it, or later in the week. Coming up on tomorrow's Tom Hartman program, conservative Mark Morano is concerned about gay couples adopting kids. I'll be asking, why deprive them of the resources to get out of institutions and become part of a happy family? Gary Weiss will be here about his book, Wall Street versus America. That and more on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.